Hello, and welcome to the third show of our third season of Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. Dave, turn your phone down. Don't forget, all our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them ever on the Racing History Project website and also on the Internet Archive, archive.org. If you missed any of our previous shows, ranging from Brian Redman, Judy Stropas, Rob Dyson, Price Cobb, etc., they're all on our website, racinghistoryproject.com, and on the podcasts from iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, and Spotify. Download the app and listen on your phone, in your car, radio, or your computer. We're going back in history tonight. And is anybody else hearing this noise in the background?
A little bit.
Yeah, I hear it. Sounds like somebody's outside in the wind.
It's Dave's phone. It's driving me crazy. I can't go on with it. Mm-mm. Okay, y'all bear with me. I'll try. Going back in history, tonight we're going to talk about the long-gone IMSA categories GTU, GTO, and the Kelly Girl Series. Tonight's show features some guys who won in these classes. Amos Johnson, if he answers his phone. Tommy Wiggins, Irv Hare, Rick Noot, Dorsey Schrader, and Jeff Klein, who was also missing, and Lance Stewart. So, audience, fasten your seatbelts and please mute your phones. And if you have a question, just send it by chat, and our producer will pass it along. We like to hear from the folks outside. I'm going to go ahead and Amos Johnson. We'll start with him, even though he's not here yet. Holds a very consistent racing portfolio with 20 wins and 61 podiums. In a career stretching from 1983 to 1992, finishing the top second and third in points on seven different championships. Tommy Wiggins drove a different car in almost every year from 81 to 2006 and making friends wherever he went. He won the Rolex GTS Championship in 2003. Dorsey Schrader, another popular guy, won the GTO Championship in 90 in the Mercury Tudor. Riley and Scott Carlos were very good to him. He's still active in the racing crowd and can be seen almost anywhere. Irv Hare was a 1992 GTU champ and also took top honors in Exxon Supreme GTS 1 group in 95-96. His racing family was one of the backbones of IMSA's golden years. Jeff Klein raced for a variety of teams and cars and was consistent in points grabber in his whole career. Second and third in points in GTO in 80 and 84. Lance Stewart won the 09 GTU Championship in the Mazda MX-6. He went on to race some of the most famous RX-7s in competition while at IMSA. And that's enough of the biographies. Anybody want to start? This is going to be mostly y'all talking. I have a few questions for you, but I guess we were going to start. Who would like to answer? How did GTU and GTO evolve? Anybody know how did you get into it?
Yeah, this is Irv Hare, and I was a GTO champion in, I don't know, either 92 or 93, I'm not sure which. But before I was actually the GTF champion, but I'd be happy to answer anything. I got into the GTO series because of Oldsmobile. That's
yep.
Where they wanted me to race that year.
And that was GTO. What kind of Oldsmobile was it?
It was a Cutlet, Oldsmobile Cutlet. And I think, I'm not sure if it was 92 or 93, but at that time, I ran a V6 engine and was able to pull it off with the V6. even though most of the cars were V8s, but the V6 could run a lighter weight.
I don't know how you could do that. Did the differences in rules and car regulations stay consistent between GTU and GTO throughout everybody's careers? Because they were different a lot.
We got a question here from the audience already.
Yeah.
Not ready for this?
I got a question from the audience.
Dave, what is it?
The question, we've got 110 people out here waiting, so somebody in the audience has a question for Irv here.
Okay.
Now, Irv, you started, I guess, in the RS series, but before that, your family was involved in racing. Tell us a little bit about your whole racing background from where you got started.
Well, my dad owned USAC stock cars, and that's back, going way back in the '60s even, and that's when USAC was actually, at that time, kind of NASCAR's counterpart, only they had the North and NASCAR had the South. He had a couple of decent Indy car drivers driving for him, Billy Foster, who was actually killed in my dad's car at Riverside.
Oh,
and then Al Unser drove for him for several years. And that's when I became interested in being a driver, because we would tire test for Firestone a lot. And Al would tell me to take the car out and warm it up because we did a lot of road courses. And I was a mechanic, you know, I was actually the chief mechanic on the car. I was a registered USAC chief mechanic at age 18. So, but that really got me hooked, and I wanted, you know, nothing more than to become a driver after that. And when I heard about the RS series, and there were factories involved, we decided to turn our attention there, and it only took 1 year, and Dotson came along and gave us some factory support for a two-car team for my brother and I, and then American Motors helped me out, and I ran the AMC Spirit, and I went from there into the Kelly Series, and ran Camaros for a couple of years, and Oldsmobile came along and offered me an opportunity to run V6 Oldsmobiles, and I ended up winning that championship in 86 and 87, and from there I went to Trans Am for a few years, and ran an Oldsmobile there, and Dorsey and I raced against each other quite a bit in those days. And from that, after that, Oldsmobile decided to go back to IMSA and run the GTS series and GTO series. And because I was actually supposed to be a GTS driver, but because the car that I was driving at Daytona expired fairly early, even though I was leading the class at the time, I didn't end up scoring any points, and so my friend Mr. Genelozzi decided that he would be a GTS driver and I would be the GTO driver. But it actually turned out pretty good because I won the GTO championship, and then the following year I resigned from the Rocket Sports team, and but Oldsmobile kept me busy running Firehawk and the International Sedan Series, and I ended up winning the International Sedan Championship and that year, and then the following year Rocket Sports lost the Oldsmobile GTS deal, and I was hired back as a driver again and ended up winning the GTS 1 championship in 95 and 96 when the program ended. And that's pretty much when I retired from full-time driving, even though I drove for George Robinson for several years after that in the major races. That's about it.
Wow, he got all I can say is Dave Rowland. All I can say about Irv Hare is I raced with him a lot, and he was always in front of me. Another question here from the audience for Lance Stewart. Are you there, Lance?
I'm here.
Tell us a little bit about your career from before you were GTU champ.
Well, I started out in 1986 driving for Honda Special Projects in the Firehawk and World Challenge Series, or whatever it was called back then, the Escort Series, I guess. Did that for a couple years, and then some local guys out in Southern California, John Overton and Jeff Alkazian, were able to get a deal with Mazda to do a GTU team for them in 1989. And they let me drive the car, and we had a pretty good season. We had some pretty neat guys, Tony Woodford, who's a pretty well-known fabricator and crew guy to this day, Bob Hubbard, who was a guy from Dorsey's neck of the woods, actually, was the kind of the guy that ran the team, crew chief, had some good engine builders, and we had a pretty good season, and Mazda asked me to drive the factory GTU car in 90. And Roger Mandeville ran that team. John Finger was my teammate. And we won the championship, driver championship, and the manufacturer championship that year. And I was able to also drive the GTO car in a few races as well. So that was pretty much the peak of what I did.
Okay. Hey, Chris. Trish, you're there. I used up all the questions.
Looks like it's just you and me,
who
Dave.
Dorsey's here. Who are you asking for?
We lost Trish.
Sounds like we lost Trish somewhere along the line here. Yeah. Dorsey, tell us the same thing. Tell us your racing story.
Well, as far as GTU and GTO is concerned, I had come out of Roush camp. Actually, I been through SCCA on many, many levels, and then ended up going with Sports Renault, and people became aware of my talent, I guess. And then I went to Dodge with Terry Earwood, with Paul Rossi in the Firestone Firehawk. And the head of Dodge at that time, rest his soul, was Dick Maxwell, great guy. And I told Dick one day I'd like to move up into a higher class again. And Cal Shokit was building a couple of GTU Dodge Daytonas on a premise that it was a really light car with a little bitty four-cylinder engine. And it had to be built extremely light. And late Charlie Cook built that in his shop. It was a 1,600-pound car with a cast iron block four-cylinder in it, and man, did it take off and run. And Tommy Kendall and Max Jones were running their Berettas. They hadn't been beat by anybody. I went out there and beat them several times. I lapped them one whole lap at California and again at Lime Rock, and then Dick told me I better slow that thing down. And it got the attention of Jack Roush, and I ended up going Trans Am racing for a year. Won the championship there in 89, and racing with Irv, just the best of the best guys in the world. I mean, there was a bunch of guys that were really talented. They moved me up to GTO in 91. Both of those things were pivotal because back in the day, if you won the Trans Am Championship or the IMSA GTO Championship, you got an invite to go into IROC, which I got to do twice. And I won both those championships, the Trans Am in 89 and the IMSA GTO 90. And then I ran the IROC in 90 and 91, and then went up to NASCAR because a few people took notice there. And Ford tried to, you know, get me a deal going there, and they backed me with a bunch of different cars. But I ended up just being a alternate driver when people got hurt. And, I guess I did okay, but I didn't win anything. I just did what I was supposed to do and not wreck the car. But I can't complain. I got no gripes about that. I mean, that was the best race there was, from Firestone Firehawk up into then GTU and then into GTO. I'm sure Irv will agree that those were the best of the best times. We had huge competition. That factories were fully involved. We were getting paid money. That all that's good.
Yeah. It was a good time, and there were some, you know, great drivers all the way from when I ran RS, you know, racing against guys like Jim Downing and Roger Mandeville and Cal Shogat and those guys did pretty well too.
Hey, Dorsey.
Okay, Rick. Anybody?
Dorsey?
Yeah.
Go ahead. This is Lance. Hey, I got a question. Did they ever do a front drive GTU chassis? Did Cal ever build one to try that out, or were they only rear drive?
No, we actually, the first year that we built those two cars, the one that Cal drove, the 07, was a front-wheel drive car. And we had a huge problem with that car because it was so light. Those were putting out pretty decent horsepower to the front wheels, you know, I'd say 350 plus. And the rear wheels were not carrying any weight at all. We were sponsored by, or we were being backed up by Yokohama and Cheech, the engineer there. There wasn't a compound light enough, or I should say sticky enough, to stick the back of the car because it didn't have any weight on it. And so we would run an entire session, and the rear tires would still have stickers on them. And that was a qualifying tire. That was the softest compound they made. And so we did that for a year or two. Cal kept pursuing it, but it never came to fruition. I ran it at Daytona with Cal for the 24-hour. This is one of the scariest things I ever did. And the car was so slippery, and it had good horsepower to weight ratio. And you know, I was going up on the banking. I came to the bus stop on the backside of Daytona, and I went up onto the banking in NASCAR Turn 3, and the thing just snapped loose, and I spun out. And while I was spun out, I was 180 degrees backwards, looking right into the windshield at these piercing eyes. Who was A.J. Foyt in the 962. And I'm like going, oh, God, don't let him kill me. I hope he doesn't see who I am. But that's honest. Got this a horrible
and he's ready. He's ready to kill you. Yeah, this is Amos.
I know. Hey, Amos,
hey.
How are you, buddy?
You made it.
Hey there.
He scared the hell out of me, I'll tell you that.
Did that chassis have any advantages over the rear drive chassis at all?
No, it really didn't. It just couldn't. You couldn't make it work. It had so much power understeer with the front wheel drive, and then the rear had zero grip at all. We could never get a balance out of it. And the rear drive car was like a little Formula Atlantic car, 1,600 pounds, engine in the front, gearbox, which was an FT200 Hewland in the back, with a live axle front to rear. And it had independent suspension, all four. And that baby at 1,600 pounds was just, it was a dream car. But the engine, unfortunately, that was a 2.2 liter, I think, stock. The bore centers weren't big enough to get any bigger than 2.5. And we had to make a big stroke on the crankshaft. And so the thing blew up a lot. And when it blew up, we graded it from a 8 to 10. And 8 would be just a basic blow-up where the pistons and the rods would all come out the side. A 10 would be when the crank went through the bottom and you caught fire. I had several of those.
Yeah, that was one of the things that in 90 that we always kind of figured, you know, as fast as the Dodges were, we just figured, you know, the percentages would give us the advantage over, you know, the long run of the season or even a race. You know, they could be really quick, but being there at the end was the key.
Yeah, they were wicked fast cars, but, you know, it had such a shake in it. It's an interesting story. It had a harmonic imbalance because of the engine being in the front, the gearbox being in the back, and the drive shaft was part of the problem. And so the drive shaft, we kept changing the weight of the drive shaft by making it steel versus aluminum, makes it, you know, we ran these crazy big aluminum drive shafts to try to get the whip out of it. And all we were trying to do is get the shake in an area where you weren't using the car that much. So you'd put it way up higher, you'd put it way down low, and you just drive through it. But what would happen would be, at the end of a straightaway, it would be shaking so hard, when you lift it off the throttle, it would blow the crankshaft out of the bottom of the pan. And that was a horrific, I mean, it was such an explosion, you wouldn't believe it. It was like funny car stuff. And it, like I say, it was a normal fire situation.
Wow. Okay, who else needs to go?
What you need?
Anybody else want to tell us a story?
Well, I can tell you a little bit.
Hey, this is Amos. Can you hear me? You hear Amos here?
Yeah, he needs to catch up on things.
Amos, I hear you. Go ahead. Tell us something.
Yeah, well, I had played with some drive shaft things. Anyway, we built a crazy car. The last one we built was an Oldsmobile Achieva, and I really took the rule book and went as far as anybody could possibly go building the car. It was just a formula car with a body on it, and for a drive shaft. We had built this thing so stiff, we took it to Oldsmobile up in Detroit, and they put it on this machine that they use for NASCAR cars to see what sort of twist they could get out of the chassis. And so they twisted our car, and they said they had never had one as stiff as that on the chassis machine. So it was so stiff that we decided that we could put the flywheel, clutch, and starter motor in the back of the car because we had a human back there. And up front, all we had was a little hub that you could stick a spline in, and we had a drive shaft that was 1-inch tubular steel that had a spline at the front and a spline at the back with no U-joints in the thing.
No center bearing.
Perfectly. No support in the center. I mean, the whole thing was only about 35 inches
live.
Long.
That's what we did too.
And
it was live.
In order to put it in there, you had to unbolt the whole rear section and to be able to put the drive shaft in place and then plug the rear section in so that you had splines out front and rear. And all of your weight was in the back, you know, with flywheel and clutch and starter motor and everything back in the back. And we found that if the plan was in the 24-hour race, and we never made it that far because our little four-cylinder engine didn't make it, but the plan was going to be at a certain point in the middle of the race, we were going to come in and unbolt the whole rear section and move it back and replace the drive shaft and put it back together. We figured it. We only had 6 bolts that held the 2 halves of the car together. But we had inboard disc brakes in the rear, and the upper A-arms were for the shock absorbers and springs, which were on top of the gearbox. And we could run wide 5 wheels that didn't weigh anything. I think we figured we got rid of about 35 pounds of unsprung weight at each rear corner. It was just a great, plus
it was rotating weight, Amos.
Hell yeah, absolutely. And so we built this thing, and the funny thing was, at the time, Harry Gant was racing an Oldsmobile in NASCAR, and GM had this engineer on staff that was coming down. He was engineering for Penske, and he was coming down south to engineer for Harry Gant, and they had him stop off at our shop. And he was looking over my shoulder at all of these things I was doing on the car, and he loved it.
Was that Terry Satchel?
Yeah, that was it. That was Terry. He absolutely loved having the chance to stop by and work with us also. But that was a crazy car, and the drive shaft, we didn't have any vibration problem. All we had was this one-inch steel tube. So it was, and we lined up the Hewlin's center line with the center line of the quad four engine that we had up front. I think the best we ever saw was like, 265 horses or something like that out of the thing. But the engine was being done by somebody else, they wouldn't even let us have an engine that we could crank. While we were at home, the car never cranked until we got to the racetrack. The fat man was doing the engine.
Oh, good.
And so we'd get to the racetrack, and they'd bring us a card to plug in, and we'd be able to crank the engine and run it. You go out and you run, you come back in, and he would pull the card and give you another one.
Yep.
And he'd take the card and go plug it into his computer and tell it things, and he didn't tell us a whole lot, but
I was in that same situation, and it sucked.
Well, we didn't like the idea that we couldn't even crank the car up, you know, until we got to the racetrack.
Same thing.
But my last race with that car was my last race. We were running, let's see, out in Oregon, and he called me into his trailer and said, "Look, I've been looking at your card, and you've never over-revved my engine." And I said, "Well, thank you very much. I try not to, since most of the time it's an engine I built." And he said, I'm gonna give you everything that this engine can give you and give you all the revs that if you want to over rev it, I'll let you go, you know, with more revs, and it's gonna read its internal temperature. After about two laps, you're not gonna have as much power. So go out in qualifying, and in the first two laps you go for it. And it was a damn good one, and I could tell the difference at the end of about two laps. All of a sudden, it wouldn't rev like it did before, and I think I qualified in the top three for the first time ever with that car, and it was a good car.
I still don't think I've ever heard anything quite like that.
People didn't understand at the time how sophisticated that we had gotten in GTU and GTO. It was an open tablet of paper, pretty much, that there was a rule book, and you had to adhere to these minimum weights and so forth. But the manufacturers took a hold of that, and they made, you know, like what Amos was talking about, the GTU car into a tube-frame car with the technology to put an engine in the front, the gearbox in the back, live drive shafts, all that. GTO went over 1,000, they went up to 1,000 horsepower. And we were running GTP brakes and tires. I mean, it was huge, huge, technology then. And the manufacturers were spending a ton of money.
But we had the chance to to really build some interesting cars, you know, when that was going on.
Hey.
Hey, hey, I can't talk to you. I'm on the cell phone.
Oh, okay, because I haven't heard you call.
It gets busy here sometimes. But that comes down to a question. You're talking about how much technology, how much did they take into consideration the different tracks? Which tracks were better or worse for GTO and GTUs or GTs in general? And is it still that way now?
Well, you know, driving for Jack Roush and driving for Chrysler, let's go to Jack Roush on GTO. We had different configurations for different tracks, and I know Irv can address this too, because even in Trans Am, there was different configurations that you would run, depending on if you're at Elkhart Lake, if you're at a Watkins Glen, if you're at Mosport where you're really going fast a lot, that'd be one type of car. But then we ran a lot of street races back then, and that would be a different type of car. That would be a much different format than the fast car on the fast track was.
Yeah, we switched back and forth from V8 to V6, and of course, when you ran the V6 car, you needed a much lighter chassis, so we had V6 cars and V8 cars, and if we were at Road America, you know, you'd use a V8 car. Anywhere up, you know, most mid Ohio, you went to a V6 car, and you know, just whatever had the advantage.
Well, we built my RX7 number 71 to be an endurance car.
I got to turn the audio.
Say what? Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I built this RX-7 to be an endurance car,
we have a question here for you.
Okay.
Okay.
Hey, Rick, we have a question here for you.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, there. Tell us about your experiences in the Toyota. That was a different car in GTU.
My GTU. Experience, I was really started with Dave Kent and Kent Racing when he was had Lee Mueller and Walt Boren were driving. So I was one of the guys they call for the longer races. And then when Dave Kent, his company was Creative Carcraft, was given the opportunity with the Toyota Celicas. I drove the 92 car, which was a fastback, for the full season sprint races and the longer races. And then Lee Mueller, he drove the 98 car, which I think at the time they called it a hatchback. And the thing that was fun was I come from an association with the Huffaker Engineering that my dad and Joe built, and Lee Mueller was a Huffaker driver in Jensen Healy's D production and the Jaguar V12. So we had an association there through Huffaker, and Dave Kent thought we were the right guys for the job. So we started the first year of Toyota's factory involvement in the GTU category. Had good engines. The cars came in relatively late to the 82 season. Our first race was at Riverside International Raceway out here in California, and we had some teething problems. But I would say that the motors were really pretty reliable. John Caldwell was the engine builder, and he came from BRE and Pete Brock and John Morton. So about halfway through the season, we were occasionally getting a podium and some durability. But it was a fabulous year. Lee was a hell of a production driver. I was driving a little bit of everything initially, and then I after the Toyota factory run I ran with the Racing Beat, ran the full season in the GTO category under Jim Meter's leadership, and they were out in Anaheim, California, and we ended up winning in the 24-hour race in our category and leading overall at the Mobile 1 12 hours of Sebring, and went out an hour and a half when a brake rotor failed. That was kind of too bad. Now, we weren't just leading GTO. We were leading the whole deal. And then I had another win at Mossport. Whenever Halsmer couldn't co-drive with me because of our Sierra IndyCar conflict, I had great backup with John Morton. And John Morton and I won at Mossport and ended up driving with John later on in GT prototypes and some other stuff. But I had two full seasons. But prior to that, you guys, I was a kind of a first responder for longer races. And absolutely, it reminded me, now I never ran IROC, Dorsey, but in the heat of the battle, the GTU category with Amos and Mandeville and all of us together, Davenport and Fitzgerald, it was almost like an IROC series. The power to weight, they Bishop did a nice job on. And I heard earlier tonight, boy, there were some real drivers there, and I concur. I really enjoyed it. So those are some of my memories.
You know, back at the end of the FCCA runoffs that went for so many years, that was pro racing at that time. There was no pro racing in sports car racing. The runoffs were pro racing, and all those names you mentioned all came out of running those years down at Road Atlanta of the runoffs. And then the technology also advanced. You know, I'll never forget the fact that Dotson at the time had their tent up on top of the hill, and they'd give away free parts. And British Leyland had their similar deal. And it was a war. I mean, it was nothing but a war, and that's where we all came from. That was our roots.
Right.
And we got a question here about the Kelly series, too. How about you, Tommy Riggins? Tell us about Kelly.
Well, I got involved with Kelly in 1980. I had done a lot of short track racing before that, and I dabbled a little bit in the couple of times in the IMSA finale in Daytona. But we saw that Kelly series is something you could get into. Looks like you could build one car and run it for a number of years, which turned out to be not right. But it got to where you were having to build a car every year and sometimes two cars a year because the rules kept changing. And if you wanted to race up front, you had to follow the rules. But it was a great series, paid well. The Kelly Services people with Connie Gudenhoff running it, they promoted it a lot. Of course, their angle was the women involved, but it paid good. You could nearly run, and what you won would get you back to the next race, which was rare in any kind of series, and much more rare now. But it was a great series. I had some success with it. The first couple of years was learning. Gene Felton had it mostly wrapped up, and then I guess Vern Smith won the next race, and then Craig Carter came in and won him a couple of championships. And I guess it was my time then in 84 and 85. And then Irv won a couple after that, and then I guess Clay Young won a couple after that. So most champions in the Kelly series were twofers. It was great. We were fortunate that we built cars, and when we were getting successful in it, then people came to us and wanted to buy them. So it became a lifeblood for the business here. But and then Buick got involved. Chevrolet was involved. Ford dabbled a little bit, and then Oldsmobile got into it with both feet. It was great. And then the V6 part of it got really important, and the main focus there for the factories was that NASCAR was going to V6s in the Busch Grand National Series, and they had nowhere to develop their V6 engines. I say nowhere. I mean, this was an ideal place because the engine specs were almost exactly what Busch was going to run. So they invested in the series to get the knowledge from the V6 stuff. But, you know, the American Sports Cavalcade was televising a lot of the races. It was just a great series. They weren't real, real long, so it didn't get terribly expensive. And
what was the real difference between the Kelly cars and GTU GTO cars?
Well, GTU was under two and a half liters maybe, and GTO was over the engine point. And then GTO, they went all the way up to 6 liter engines, I guess. The Kelly cars were a lot more limited. We had smaller tires. We were held to a 10-inch wheel and steel wheel, and then you had to run a production 4-speed transmission. Still a tube-frame car, eventually got to a tube-frame car, and quick changes and limited brakes. But the races weren't as long. I guess the GTO stuff, and then I got involved in the GTO stuff after 85. But those were 3 hours and up. Long distance races, and Kelly stuff generally was 45 minutes or so, and they were, I guess, 75-mile races. So you didn't really kill your car just to get to the checkered flag.
Yeah, as far as the Kelly car being similar, they were more similar to a GTO car, but I know that in 86 and 87 there, when I ran the Kelly series, I actually had a car that we would bring to each race and run GTO with it, and it was nothing but the same car that I was running in the Kelly series. We lowered it to the ground a little bit and put bigger wheels and tires on it, and I ended up getting a couple podium finishes with that car.
Yeah, back in 82, I think. We got really ambitious and had a lot of energy, and we owned a V8 engine as well, a small inch V8 for the Kelly series, but then a bigger inch V8 we came across, and we were swapping engines between sessions at the Daytona Finale to practice in one and then qualify in the other. Boy, that was the day when you had mm-hmm. a lot of energy and less sense. But the same car could run. You just wouldn't be quite completely as competitive in GTO with a Kelly car because they were built with heavier minimum weight and smaller tires, smaller wheels and tires and things. But Irv got real successful with running his Kelly car, and he run some Trans Am stuff with it against the, which was those were almost semi GTO style cars back then.
My Trans Am cars in 88 and 89 and actually 90 were nothing but my Kelly car chassis, a little bit lower to the ground and set up the Trans Am specs with, you know, for weight and engine wise. And that they handled really well because, Tommy, they were short track cars. We had 3 lengths in those cars, and you know, I remember when the Riley cars and everything, when they discovered 3 lengths years after that.
yeah. Well, it was a fallacy with their 4-length stuff, but that's what they had. I can tell you that right now, the Trans Am 2 class is almost exactly what the Kelly series was back in the 80s. And that's one of the more successful series going in road racing right now for an average person.
That's the best series there is right now in road racing. I mean, that TA2 is a car you have to get up on the wheel, you got to drive the car. It's old school technology, and those boys are doing a hell of a job. They're putting on the best show there is right now. And you're right, Tommy. That's exactly an old school car. That's an old T you know, when Irv ran that V6 car against me in Roush's V8, when we'd go to a street course, I couldn't beat that car. That car was, you know, unless it was attrition, that car had me beat. I could be fast and straight away. I'd beat him on the long, you know, like Elkhart Lake and Road Atlanta and all that. But man, you get to a street course, and we were running a bunch of them back then, that little V6 would get it done.
Well, you could run. You were running pounds.
It came off a corner without spinning the tires.
You would run a lighter weight, and by the end of your fuel stint, the V6 car would be eating your lunch. I drove the Protofab Camaro V6 car in 87, and there was two races where I came within a half a straightaway of winning overall. One of them was against the Celica in Riverside, but you had to wait, you know, you just had to bide your time because you had a whole lot more tire at the end of a stint than the V8s, and the V8s were slipping and sliding and spinning, and you know, they slowed significantly down, but your V6 car would maintain its start, you know, its first lap pace really close on your at the end of the hour. So that was the advantage of the V6 cars.
Yeah, for sure.
And what happened to the Orange Series? Yeah.
What happened to what?
Yeah, Ashley Amos, you were probably around then. It became Kelly American, and then it went away. What happened there?
Well, I can tell you, Kelly. Well, I can tell you a little bit about it. When Kelly Services, you know, had all their benefit that they were looking for out of it, IMSA turned it into they called it American Challenge.
Right.
And that they ran it that way because it had large fields, fairly large fields, so they didn't want to lose that. And then when IMSA GTO eventually killed itself, they turned that series, that class, those cars, they turned them into the GTO class.
Well, I ran the same car in GTO and in Kelly, running an AMC AMX, and I couldn't really run with you guys up front, Riggins and Felton, and the best finish I got out of it was at Elkhart Lake one time. I finished third. The only way I did that was you guys up front kept banging on each other and knocking each other out of the race.
There you go.
Well,
Tommy and I never did that.
No. They're called short track cars for a reason.
I'm supposed to do a station identification, and it got away from me. This is Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. Listen to all our shows forever on Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and on the Internet Archive, archive.org, and on iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, and Spotify podcasts. Okay, take it away, y'all. I'm required to do that. Okay.
I was telling you about about that GTU Oldsmobile that I did. I forgot to tell you what the chassis was. We had to have a tube frame, so we did that. But we made the bottom rails a CC tube with the open on the inside on each side, and I had Jim Downing make me a 1-inch honeycomb aluminum tub. And we slid the tub in in the rails, and we had a tube frame on top, but the floor pan was a 1-inch honeycomb aluminum, and we had to have a flat bottom steel, so we glued a piece of stainless steel that covered the whole bottom. And we had the fuel cell was like saddlebags over the drive shaft and where the transaxle was, and we had a double fuel cell in there, and that was all a part of the tub frame that Downing made for me. We had him make three of those, two for the cars that Scott drove. Scott Hare drove one, and I drove the other one. Unfortunately for us, I guess Paul Genelozzi got his GTO car going so well that they took our program away halfway through the year and fed it all to Genelozzi.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, several of us lost our program, so to speak, to Mr. Genelozzi. He came in and was willing to spend, you know, more money or add more money along with what Oldsmobile was spending. And I know my I had a deal and I had Trans Am cars at the time. And they ended that and put the support to the Rocket Sports team. And fortunately, they had me become one of the Rocket Sports drivers. And that lasted a couple of years, and then I resigned, and then I rejoined the bigger GT cars again 1 year later when Rocket Sports left.
Yeah, I guess
there's
something to be said for your shop and your business being in the hometown of Oldsmobile, Lansing, Michigan.
Yeah, right.
Well, I think we all went through those problems where you had a good deal for a couple of years and then something happened and it moved on and left you without a paddle. But we'd gotten used to working with Mazda. I had Mazda for 10 years, and we got so used to working with them. They were nice people to work with. They said, we'll give you this much money, and you do these races. And they just turned you loose that way. It was up to you to handle it. When we got to Oldsmobile, we found out that you had to put the bill for everything up front and then submit all these invoices to get them to repay you up to a certain amount that they had said your deal was for. And the problem was that if you went out and got a sponsor that was going to give you, say, $10,000, then Oldsmobile would subtract $10,000 from your overall deal.
Ooh.
And it just didn't work. Now, Scott Hare was real nice to me. He had been working with Oldsmobile, and he said, look, what you got to do, and Irv can confirm this, what you got to do is you got to get some dummy receipts, and you put those receipts in before you spend all your money on it so that you've got their money coming in. And their money comes in. If it happened to hit at the right time, they would send you the money right away. If the guy that was handling your deal happened to be on vacation for a couple of weeks, your money might not get to you for 90 days.
Wow.
Yeah, well, that was a little strange, and I knew about those kind of deals because my brother Scott had one in Firehawk and, I don't know, GTO or GTU and whatever. But the deal that I had with Oldsmobile was quite a bit different. I was basically the first road race team to have real Oldsmobile support, and my deals were always a flat amount, and then any sponsorship I could find would add to that. And but the problem was when somebody would come along and say that they were going to match what Oldsmobile put in personally, then that's how I ended up losing my deal. But they guaranteed me that if I wasn't happy in a year, that we'd go back to our old deal. And at the end of that year, the Oldsmobile program was gone, and it all became the GM race shop. So the whole thing changed, and all promises made had been forgotten. But yeah, fortunately, right. I stayed with Oldsmobile, and I can't complain because I was with them for 11 years. So,
you know, coming up as a young guy, and the one thing I took out of the whole deal was that you had to align yourself with a manufacturer if you're going to be in the game for a long time. And, you know, how are you going to stay in a road racing game for a long time and make money at it? You have to, you know, make alliances with somebody. And, you know, that was the key to longevity, not success, but longevity. And then, you know, like these guys are talking about, those deals go sour or they go away. I know I had worked for Ford, you know, working for Jack Roush and getting paid well and having a great time and having a great living and not have to worry. And then Robbie Gordon comes along and, and Ford decides to get out of sports car racing and go IndyCar racing. And he's 20 years younger than I am. And guess what happens? I got to look for something.
Yep.
You know, and it's happened to all of us. It happens to all of us. One day you're sitting in the catbird seat and the next day you're cat shit. You know,
because like I say, the road racing in General Motors was Oldsmobile was their designated shooter. But when the Corvette program came along, that ended everything. And the Corvette program still there.
Yep. I mean, there's good and bad to all of that, but, you know, you ride that gravy train as long as you can ride it. And when it goes away, you're at the bottom of the bowl.
Yeah, I mean, I was fortunate the first year that Oldsmobile came in. I was basically the only team they had, and I ended up winning, I think, 9 out of 11 races in the Kelly Series and the championship. And after that, it seemed like I was tenured. You know, no matter what they did, I was going to be included in it. And up all the way up to the end, actually, which was good. You know, they were very loyal to me. I can't complain.
The bad thing with being the youngest guy like I was coming up from the bottom was that I made all these alliances with all these guys, and then they died.
Yeah.
And you know, you guys, you got to remember that half of our audience doesn't even know what an Oldsmobile is anymore.
Right, exactly.
And anybody else raced to Plymouth, no one knows what that is either, you know.
Yeah. No, that's okay. Exactly right.
I had a pretty good deal going with Mazda, you know, to work with them for as long as we did. But we got into it because Roger Mandeville took me on as a co-driver. Roger and I had a history way back when he first came down from Canada, and I was racing the AMCs, and he shows up and the first Mazda that he got was actually from a team highball teammate of mine. Dr. Paul Fleming bought the first Mazda that came into Raleigh and turned it into his race car. And he was the first road racing Mazda in the United States. And then he got tired of racing and he just turned the car over to Roger. So Roger was racing an RX2 and he was bringing his engines up from Spartanburg, South Carolina, up to Raleigh on the weekends and breaking them in on my dyno. And I was dynoing engines for Roger Mandeville and then racing against him. But we were perfectly matched, you know, the two of us. And so then he said, why don't you co-drive with me in the RX-7? So I got into GTU and then GTO with Roger in the RX-7s, and that kind of got my foot in the door with Mazda because we were doing real well. And then they called me one time and said, Tom Walkinshaw went snow skiing and he broke his leg, and we've got to replace him at Daytona in a 24-hour race. Can you get out of your RX, get out of your AMX and get in my RX-7? I said, you bet. So I took a ride at Daytona, taking Walkinshaw's place, and at the end of 18 hours, I think that was the second year that the RX-7 ran there. At the end of 18 hours, that car was in fifth place overall in the race. And then the engine went south, and we were out of it. But after that, they said, you can come and drive it at Sebring. So I stayed with the car to go to Sebring, only they decided that we were too fast for GTU, so they said we were going to put 400 pounds of lead in the car. And our comp manager said, no way. So we ran it as a GTX car at Sebring and did pretty well with it. But we didn't get credit for winning GTU. We just got, like, fourth place in GTX. But that was my first ride with Mazda, and as long as you kept winning, they kept supporting you, and that went right on until they got into GTP, and Dirty Dick took over running the program, and he took all of our other Mazda money away and put it all into the GTP cars.
Hmm. Now, Amos, didn't you go to the Nürburgring with a Kelly car?
That one, the Kelly car, I was sitting down with a B.F. Goodrich guy and an AMC guy, and I said, I know that over in Europe they're racing cars like this AMX that we were doing. We were doing the Spirit AMX. I said, they're racing these things over in Europe as an FIA GT car. So it would be great to go over there and run the 24-hour of Nürburgring where we're running against and we were drinking, and they said that sounded great to them. So I had right there B.F. Goodrich and American Motors willing to do this. But the car had just come out. They were in the dealerships, and so AMC found me four of them, and I wound up buying four AMX, Spirit AMXs. I think, actually, I only paid like $100 a piece for them. And we got them in the shop. We only had 1 month to prepare the car, so we weren't able to do very much to them. But we took them over. They had to have homologation papers done. So a guy from England flew over to Kenosha, and flew up there and met him in Kenosha, and we went through the factory and we took pictures of whatever I liked to put on the car, and he put those into the papers to make it that was what an AMX was exactly, only it wasn't. And they had to promise that they were going to make 5,000 of those cars, and they didn't, but it got us in the race. And so we had these funky homologation papers, and they said, okay, camshaft, we got to have a camshaft in this engine. And I said, okay. And I just remembered some numbers from one of my four-cylinder cars, and I said, let's do a nice mild cam. We'll do 32, 64, 32. They're my numbers. And for the intake opening and the exhaust opening and closing and all of that. And we put those in the papers, and the guy from England flew them to France and got them stamped. And meantime, we got cars coming in, and we managed to get all of that done in 1 month's time. And B.F. Goodrich loaded them up on a brand new tractor trailer that was painted to match the cars, and put them on a boat and sent them over. And they had to come through Belgium to get to Germany, and they didn't have two sets of papers, and so when they got to Belgium, they used up one set of papers, and when they got to Germany, they didn't have papers, so they got stuck at the border trying to get in, and the drivers and crew were over at Nürburgring waiting for the cars to show up, and I had Lynn St. James, Gary Witzenberg, and Jim Downing, and Dennis Shaw, and myself were the five, the four, six drivers for the two cars. Downing couldn't believe that I asked him to go over there, but Roger was tied up with Japan and couldn't go with me, and so I said, okay, let me take Jim with me. So he was my co-driver along with, let's see, B.F. Goodrich got actor, but Jim, who's the actor that's married to, Jim Brolin. Jim Brolin. Yeah. My wife Bunny's monitoring. So Jim Brolin was our surprise driver. And it turns out he was a pretty decent driver. He needed a little bit of practice, and so we took one of our RS cars up and rented the track at Mid-Ohio so he could drive the RS car. That's about what the other one was going to be like. We wound up with a little over 300 horsepower, you know, and a lot of good AMC parts that I found at the factory. So it turned into a pretty decent car. Brolin was going around the racetrack. And there was nobody there besides us, you know, the AMC people and my crew. And Roland came out of that last turn at Mid-Ohio, and when he looked over the pit wall, he saw six moons over the top of the guardrail. The crew all mooned him over the guardrail. It was a crazy trip, and we ran 24 hours, and our class of over 3.5 liters consisted of two cars, and we finished first and second. And B.F. Goodrich filmed it all. You can go on YouTube right now and put in Team Highball Nürburgring, and you'll get to see that race, about a 25-minute program on that race. And one of those cars, when it came back, we turned it into a GT car and a Kelly car. That's the one that finished third up at Elkhart Lake in Kelly.
Great story. Any more questions here from the audience before we wrap things up? I guess not. So, Trish, you're on here. By the way, April 19th is the date for the next one.
Okay. I need to check the schedule and see who's doing what in IMSA that time.
Yeah, we'll go ahead and wrap it up.
Okay. Oh, goodness, y'all. I've had fun. I hope you have, too.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it was. They always are. Well, that's one thing I will say. Next month, April 19th, a recap of the Sebring 12-hour with the winners, the losers, in past, present, and future. Until then, thanks for the great stories and for our audience, people out there listening live, thanks for listening. And our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website. Also on the Internet Archive, archive.org, also on the Internet Archive and on iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, Spotify. Whew!